This year marks the 25th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. At 1:23 a.m. on April 26, 1986, operators in the control room of reactor number 4 botched a routine safety test, resulting in an explosion and a fire that burned for 10 days. The radioactive fallout spread over tens of thousands of square miles, driving more than 250,000 people permanently from their homes. It remains the world's worst nuclear disaster to date. That's from a recent article in the Huffington Post about the 25th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
The destructive potential of over 100 atom bombs was released at Chernobyl. 25 years after the accident that sent radioactive clouds for thousands of miles, what has become of the contaminated areas of Ukraine, Russia, and Belarus? Who calls this land home now? And what lingering health effects are found? What lessons have we learned from the Chernobyl disaster? And are there any parallels with the current nuclear crisis in Japan? Joining us to explore Chernobyl 25 years later is Norma Berkowitz, Professor Emerita of Social Work at the UW-Madison, and the founder of a nonprofit organization called FOCUS, Friends of Chernobyl Centers U.S.
Welcome to University of the Air. We always want comparisons when we have these natural disasters. I think it's human nature to want to say, well, how big is it compared to this, or how bad is it compared to that? And, of course, the situation in Japan is very much with us and probably will be with us for a long time. How does this 1986 catastrophe at Chernobyl compare to the Japanese situation? And what makes it so much worse?
The Chernobyl disaster? I think it was so much worse because there was so much more destruction. There were so many more lives lost. There were so many more people who were exposed because they had to come on site and walk in there and throw the water by hand.
Oh, but well, for one thing, they didn't have seawater handy as we do in Japan.
No, well, they had river water, but not as much as they would have needed.
So take us to Chernobyl, 1986. For one thing, tell us exactly where it is and sort of what the place was like before this happened.
Chernobyl is up in northern Ukraine, not far from the Belarus and Russian borders. And it's in an area of a very, very ancient civilization that goes back to the 8th century or something like that. And it was very rich in the area was given to a nobleman, a Russian nobleman, because of his outstanding military action. And nobody lived there. So he started from scratch. And to build what he wanted to build, he had to bring people from Russia and from the nearby communities and from everywhere. And the area had a very unique culture called the Polisia culture. And that still exists to some extent today. But because of the Chernobyl disaster, people are leaving that area all the time. And there's a lot of concern now about trying to maintain, you know, the uniqueness that was there as part of that culture.
And why did the Soviets, it would have been at the time, decide to put a nuclear reactor there in that particular place?
Because it had water supply, for one thing. And it was far from heavily populated areas. And they could decide to put it wherever they wanted.
They didn't have to do a lot of consulting.
And they didn't have to worry about boundaries because Belarus and Russia and Ukraine were all part of the Soviet Union. And there was a lot of space.
This was, what, mostly agricultural land at the time?
It was absolutely. And there was a lot of space. And I have to tell you, a lot of times when people think about the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, you know, they can think about a power plant that they see as they go through the countryside in America. It's a building, you know. This site in Chernobyl extends 9 miles, and it had not one nuclear reactor, but 4 and a fifth one being built.
So it was and they, huge.
The Soviets wanted it to be the hugest,
always
biggest.
Thought big, didn't they?
They sure did.
And in retrospect, what did they do wrong in the construction of this site?
Oh, okay. I can't speak for the other reactors, but I think they're the same, and they are now all dismantled. Although they didn't end their production until the year 2000. So
really?
the Ukrainians and the Russians let them go on in spite of that, the catastrophe. But what happened in the Chernobyl building, first of all, it didn't have a roof.
Roof at all.
Well, it had a roof, but not a strong roof.
Is that the same as the containment cap, or is that different?
The containment is after the disaster, isn't it, that you cover the thing up?
Yeah. Well, you have to have a building that has a strong walls, floors, and roof. It had a roof, but it didn't have a roof that was built to withstand a disaster. So one night, the night shift was on, and the boss had gone home, and he said, we're supposed to check this safety, do this safety check to make sure that the dials work at the right pressures and so forth. So why don't you do that tonight? I don't want to do it during the day because it'll interrupt the electricity in Kiev and everybody will get mad at us. So just run this little thing tonight. So they did, but they didn't do it right. They turned off the safety valves. They left things open a few seconds too long, and then they couldn't stop it. And it just went boom.
Literally a big explosion.
Literally a big, huge explosion.
And what was the upshot of that explosion in terms of what did that put into the atmosphere?
Everything that would go into a nuclear power plant, especially strontium, cesium, iodine, all the rest of it.
And some of those have much longer half-lives than others. I think strontium has a very long half-life.
I think
compared
it's,
to cesium.
Yes, yes. Very, very long. They have 3 or 4 half-lives that are longer than a life. and that's one of the problems still today. They say the cesium, for example, that went into the soil will be there for 250 years. So that's a long time.
Yeah.
Let's say 56,000 square miles that has cesium or other things
cesium
in the soil
and
that's
strontium.
Going to be there for
the cesium has the longest
250
life. Strontium is not so long.
So that land, that soil is useless, that 56,000 square miles?
Well, there are people living on it.
Well,
and they have to be careful what they eat.
We've heard about people even sneaking back into some of those villages that were evacuated.
That's right.
That's right.
And I've met some of them.
Well, let's talk about what happened immediately after this happened, because looking at it now with hindsight, did they do the right thing in terms of who was evacuated and how they handled the crisis?
No. The Soviets did not put anything out on the air until three days afterward.
Acknowledging the accident.
The Swedish government were the ones that picked up what was going on. And they broadcast it over international airwaves and so forth. But the Soviet government did not make any public announcement about this until 3 days afterwards. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't try to take people out of the contaminated areas closest to the zone. They did. They did. But they didn't let – they were afraid of the public going crazy over this kind of thing because nobody was prepared for it. I'm going to a conference in Kiev on the 25th anniversary, and one of the sessions is on emergency preparedness, emergency evacuation things. Well, there was not any kind of evacuation procedure set up in case of emergency.
So it was all done very quickly. I remember just a couple of years after that event in Chernobyl, that there was this exhibit at the Madison Children's Museum of works of art done by children who had lived in that zone, and I believe all of them were dead by the time we saw the art, and it was done while they were in hospitals. It was done on the backs of pieces of wallpaper and whatever they could find. But there were some recurring images in those pictures, one of which was this sense of quickly abandoned houses, pets that were left behind, things left, possessions, toys left on the lawns. And one image I remember in particular of an ambulance that had run into a ditch. And all the symbolism kind of spelled this hasty disaster.
That's what it was. Pripyat was the closest city, and they were the first, to be evacuated. But they got a knock on their door, and some Russian soldier said, "Well, there's been a little accident, and we think it would be best if you leave here. So pack a little suitcase for 3 days, but you'll be back in 3 days." Mm-hmm. And that's what they were told.
And who were the first responders, the ones that actually went to deal with the blazing fire and the disaster itself?
Military, mostly. Although there were volunteers. Once this became known, there were people who realized that unless they went and did something about it, it was going to get worse.
Did they know, these responders, that it was going to be a suicide mission for some of them? Did they know that they were unprepared?
For the civilian responders? I think that the military certainly had some idea that this would be the case. Yes.
I guess I'm still stuck, too, on the idea that just a routine safety inspection could lead to such a huge disaster. Because one difference with the Japanese situation is that with the tsunami, with the earthquake, it seems, you know, different, because that's something nobody could sort of do much about. Yeah. It's a natural disaster. But this other, where it's just kind of human error, it seems odd to me that it would be constructed in such a way that there wouldn't be more checks against human error.
Well, that's the way it was. And maybe it's a cultural difference.
The Soviets were pretty much famous for their ecological disasters that would be consistent with this. And even in their military hardware, there were some pretty casual approaches to atomic power in the submarines,
right,
for example.
Yes, yes. And attention to details.
it was not high on their list of priorities.
Yeah, yeah.
What would be the sort of expected first symptoms of a disaster like this, if you are looking at the environment, people's health, also mental health effects, sort of immediately after, within those first months?
Well, panic, you know. And I have a colleague who directs now one of the community centers that Focus supports, and she said that it was in a community not too far from Kiev. And she said remember the pictures you saw of parents throwing their kids on trains to get away from the Nazis? She said there were parents bringing their kids down and putting them on the train, and all they had was their name and address, and that was it. And the parents didn't know where these kids were going to end up.
They
just knew they had to get them out of this environment, or they would be early deaths.
So it actually turned out that the weather did it not tend to drift this cloud over Scandinavia, northern Scandinavia, fairly quickly. I seem to recall that the was it the Swedes, I think, had to actually lower their standards for radiation in reindeer milk and meat affected the Sami peoples in the far north of Scandinavia.
Yeah. You know, I think that, and maybe we can talk about this later, people's feeling of vulnerability, and that is that this material that was sent into the sky because of the explosion, it went wherever the wind took it. And so the Swedes could measure it and knew that it had happened, and I think they could trace where it was coming. But it went east, and then it went north, and then it went west, and then it went north, you know, whichever way the wind blew. One of the problems of trying to figure out who was affected by this and trying to come up with some sort of a formula, it doesn't work because it depends.
It was too capricious.
It was too capricious. It depended where you were living, whether the wind turned there, whether it rained and dropped the water, you know. And I think there's something about us as human beings who wants to be able to predict. You know?
I suspect that it would be interesting to know. I'm sure that people who have studied the timelines could give you an answer. But I've suspected for a long time that the nuclear arms race seemed to end with Chernobyl when the nuclear powers realized in very graphic terms that there was no controlling the results of, say, a first strike.
Yeah.
That you would just as likely be breathing it as the person struck.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I wish that what you said were true, that it was the end of the nuclear thing, but it's a powerful demonstration, right? And my wish is that we learn from what happened at Chernobyl, and what we learn from what happens in Japan, and that we don't just learn, but we act on what we learn, and that's going to be a hard process.
We're going to look at Chernobyl 25 years later when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Norma Berkowitz, and we are talking about Chernobyl, a nuclear disaster that is now marking its 25th anniversary. I have to ask you, since you're a retired social work professor from UW, what is it that led you to go from your field, social work, to becoming involved in starting an organization called FOCUS to help the Chernobyl centers?
Well, I think I'm still involved in social work. I think that what I'm doing with FOCUS is very definitely social work. It's at a different level than a lot of people. It's at an international level. And I got into it because just about when I was ready to retire, a colleague of mine in London said, Norma, English social work is different from American social work. And would you be willing to edit a book on social work in the United States that would be used at a university in Russia? Oh, I thought that sounded quite a challenge. So I said, sure. And then a friend of mine said, if you're going to do that, don't you think you better at least visit Russia once? He said, there's a conference outside Moscow this summer, and I'm going, why don't you go too? So I said yes. And while I was there, I met the people that had been just hired by UNESCO to set up a series of community centers in areas severely affected by the Chernobyl disaster, and went back the following year to talk with them again, and at that point decided that this was something I would like to pursue.
What drew you into it? What struck you as
first? These people were very smart. They were very dedicated. They were very wanting to learn. Most of the human services people in the Soviet Union were psychologists who were behavioral psychologists, and they didn't have any of the other, you know, interpersonal kinds of theories or models. And so these two conferences that I went to were addressed to that. And that just started the whole thing.
What would be your approach, though, as a social worker going into the vicinity of Chernobyl 25 years after the fact? You are helping people to cope psychologically with this long shadow of this nuclear disaster, the greatest nuclear disaster. There's still a great deal of psychological dismay.
Yeah. I don't do that, and Focus doesn't do that. What we do is support right now the five centers in Ukraine that were established in the mid-1990s by UNESCO. And they are the ones who are doing all the work in those five communities to meet people's psychosocial needs, to help them engage in a community kind of way. The sense of community has just gone kaput in these areas.
Well, if you can't inhabit the community, that's a handicap.
Well,
right there.
These centers are located in communities where people are living. And so they have there's a very small community, and then there's that is up by the Chernobyl, closest to the Chernobyl disaster. And that was an agriculture community with the rich Polesia culture. And they can't do anything. I mean, it was such an agricultural community. So the centers are trying to help people come to grips with their disappointment, their depression, their fear of being ill. And all of the centers that we support are in that business. And so we support the staff. We give grants to the centers for certain projects. We provide consultation by mail if somebody gets, one of the directors or staff gets stuck. We go over there and do in-service training. We bring the staff here for in-service training. So we're not directly involved in the interactions with the people, per se.
But you're helping to facilitate them. I noticed that in some of the literature from Focus, your organization, it talked about people's post-radiation and mental health illnesses. What kinds of health problems do you see in the people who are survivors of Chernobyl? What kinds of, you know, what sorts of cancer, what sorts of mental health illnesses? What is it that you can point to and say this is the health damage of that disaster?
Okay. Well, first of all, and you can't do anything. There are the deniers, and they're doing just fine. They just deny that anything has happened and anything is wrong. There's no reason why you shouldn't eat the food and so on.
You mean literally deny that it happened or just deny that there's any serious health impact?
Yeah, well, they say, yeah, it happened, so what?
Uh-huh, okay.
You know?
Right.
So we don't have to do much with them. The older people, of course, feel very victimized. Why us? Why did this have to happen in our neighborhood? Why couldn't it be someplace else? And why don't people do more to help us? And why do I have to live my life in fear of cancer, and or that my kids are going to have cancer? That's part of the answer to your question.
And how real is their fear?
Pretty real. And we don't know how real, because the cancer impact will not be totally felt for at least another 10 years. But right now, the incidence of cancer in these people is going up.
Is this mostly thyroid?
No, all kinds. But the thyroid cancer immediately hit the young kids who were exposed right away. So there's a lot of kids who had their thyroid removed and are doing fine. And they originally thought that would be it. But now they're finding older children, young adults, who are increasingly coming down with thyroid cancer.
I guess that's the real difficulty with a nuclear disaster, is that so many of the effects can take so long to manifest themselves.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
Is much known about the effect that the disaster would have had on women who were pregnant or of childbearing age?
Yes. The hundreds, thousands of women who were pregnant had abortions, and they were advised to have abortions. Now, the question is, and we've done, we've provided grants to do some of this, is to the teenagers who are thinking about getting married, you know, they're not oblivious to the impact that this has had. So we're trying to help them think through their future of getting married or not getting married. What are the risks? What would you do if, you know, these are all questions that are in the back of the minds of these young adults.
And would they still be at risk even though they were born after the disaster? In other words, if it's been 25 years, and you know, let's say you have someone who's 18 and gets pregnant.
Yes.
Still, you still are going to see the lingering effects from the birth of that person years after the disaster?
Yeah, I think that there isn't enough known. And as I said, I think we live in a culture where we want to know. And this is something where we just aren't going to know.
Well, we have, you know, something of a prototype getting back to Japan in, of course, the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But those are relatively small atomic bombs, like, what, 15 kilotons or something. And you have some information here that says that the destructive potential of over 100 atom bombs was released at Chernobyl.
Yes.
That's so hard to fathom.
So a vastly more enormous factor of destruction on people's health.
Yes. The other thing that is different is that the Hiroshima bombs went off
overhead,
you know, up high. This rolled right through the countryside in many places.
If you look at the environment effect on woods, you know, trees, on animals and so on, what was seen sort of immediately after the disaster, and what do you find if you go back there now?
Well, there is an exclusion zone around the plant, which is, I think, about 15-mile circle. And that's where the most devastating effects were. Right afterwards, and there are lots and lots of pine trees, pine forests. And after the disaster, the pine forest close to the Chernobyl plant all turned red. And there were miles and miles of red forests and red ground. And then they all burned. So that was one aspect. By the way, that forest is regrown and it's coming back green, but stunted.
But don't use the wood.
don't burn the wood. So that was one thing. There was also a prediction that the land around there would be barren for a long time, but that hasn't happened. It's grown, and because no people live in that area, it's grown fast and it's thick and so on. It was also assumed that there would be very little wildlife. Well, There's even been books written about it now. There are huge boars and huge wild horses and huge kinds of other wildlife scurrying around all over the place. So people are saying, see, it might not be so bad.
Oh.
But some of the researchers, I think from South Carolina, are very involved in this. And they are going into the DNA, and they're seeing changes in some of the DNA. So it's not all what it appears to be.
In other words, we're going to see some mutations there that might not be desirable by any account of this wildlife in the 15-mile radius exclusion zone. That's enormous.
Yeah.
What about the water and the fish and so on? And mentioned there were rivers that were near the Chernobyl plant.
Well, they've managed pretty clearly to keep the water out of the river that ran down, the Dnieper River. And the Dnieper, well, it's up there, it's called something else. I forget.
Major river, though.
But it runs into the Dnieper. And that's a major river that goes from the top of Ukraine down to the sea. And it comes right through the middle of Ukraine. And millions and millions and millions of people live along that river. And they have not had any trouble so far with the water in that river. Thank God.
But it is, as you say, unpredictable as to what's going to be safe and what's not when you get one of these events, especially one this size.
Yes. Oh, yes.
I saw on one news report that they're talking about having tourist expeditions to this area.
Yes.
Seems like a kind of an odd thing, but I suppose it would bring money back into
the
region.
That's the point, yes.
I mean, do you have to have a hazmat suit to go in there as a tourist?
Well, I've been there, and I didn't have one of those things.
How close were you to?
Right across from the plant.
Within the 15-mile zone, really?
Yes.
How did you feel about that?
I wanted to go there, so it didn't bother me. One of the centers that we support is the Center Slavutich, and it's about 20 miles from the plant. And that was the city that was built to rehouse the people who worked at the Chernobyl plants. So that's where the people live, and they ride a train every day back and forth to the Chernobyl site. And there are still 3,000 people working at that site because they
those
have
other
to,
three reactors?
They have to shut down the reactors. They have to clean up the place. And there are, I can't tell you how many tons of spent nuclear fuel that is just sitting there.
The rods?
They're not the rods, but I don't know how you define spent nuclear fuel. But anyhow, there are tons of it sitting around this place.
So what's really needed then?
They just hired somebody to take all that out of there. And it's an American firm and it's going to take years. But hopefully that will reduce the danger on the site.
What about this containment cap, though, that we've heard about? That was rather hastily applied, wasn't it, back in 1986? And
yes.
What's the status of that?
That's what I saw when I stood there and looked at it, and it looked pretty good, and there was no problem. But that was maybe 8 years ago, and it was not that well constructed. So in the meantime, the steel has started to rust. And water is leaking in there, and once water gets in there, anything can happen.
And what does it cost to put on a new one? I've seen a figure of about $1 billion.
Oh, it's more than that. Mm-hmm. It's more than that. $92 million this year, and it's billions. Just billions of dollars.
And I gather the Ukrainian treasury isn't exactly fine fettle.
They can't, no. But they have gone to the European, the bank of the
European bank.
And have received a lot of money from them because the Europeans.
Well, it's in everyone's best interest, isn't
right.
it, to cap
right.
thing.
And what do politics, how do politics play a role with this, you know, with the changing politics in that region over the last 25 years? Who sort of is responsible for dealing with Chernobyl and how do the kind of changing political structures of the areas play a role?
Well, Chernobyl comes under the political structure of the rest of what was the Soviet Union, and there were vested interests and there were bribes, and when the Soviet Unions went away, that didn't go away. So there's been a lot of corruption, in this business of trying to shut down the plant and clean up the place and put in a new sarcophagus.
Which is what those containment caps are called. The thing that would, the enclosure for
yes,
the...
Yes, yes. The sarcophagus is the enclosure
this is
over
certainly
the,
an apt name.
Of the... yeah, I think so.
So, but you seem to be saying, Norma, that just... throwing money at this problem won't necessarily improve things because the level of corruption on the local level is such that the money
well, could
it's
not just the local level. It's
at the national level.
And I hate to say this, but Ukraine is seen as one of the most corrupt nations in the world today. And it is, and the Chernobyl instance is not immune from that. So I think the new Ukrainian government is taking some steps to try and find out what's going on. The European Union and the United States are saying, don't ask us for more money. Look what you've done to what you've already given us. And it's going to be interesting to see. They have gone so far as to start the ditches where they're going to start building this new covering. But that's as far as they've gotten, and I don't know if they'll have enough money to even get the ditches up to the existing building. But it's a terrible problem. And the thing that's being constructed, to give you some sense of this, is that it will be big enough to house the Statue of Liberty or the Cathedral in London.
St. Paul's. Which is a pretty good-sized place.
Huge. And how important is it that that be built? In other words, if the money's not raised and it doesn't get built, does it matter?
Are still 200, more than 200 tons of active nuclear material seeping along under that cover. And if it gets wet, boom.
We're going to look further at the future of Chernobyl when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Norma Berkowitz, who's filling us in about Chernobyl, 25 years after the world's most substantial nuclear disaster. What is the place around it like, and what is the future of that place likely to be? We always have to ask as Americans, what is the American government, what are American technicians able to do about Chernobyl, which is a place that still needs considerable shoring up to make it safe.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the U.S. is actually the largest individual donor or contributor to the building of this new shelter. So that's part of what we do. I think the other places where aid from the United States comes is there have been studies by the National Institute of Health and other national agencies studying the long-term health effects And that's a big development and a very, very serious need is to keep track of the health effects. And the United States is playing a big role in that. One of the things that the U.S. did was develop a mobile environmental laboratory so that professionals can go out into these affected areas and on the spot can do the analysis that they need and want to do. They have also trained people about the dangers and how to cope with forest fires in the exclusion zone, and that's a real threat. You may remember that about a month ago there was a huge fire in that area, and they were terrified that it was going to get into the Chernobyl zone.
Why would that be so bad?
Well, because it would just go up so quickly. And if it ever got to the site itself and got to the building, you know, it would just go boom.
And put it into the atmosphere.
Yeah. And one of the other things that they've been doing is to help the Ukrainians prevent nuclear smuggling. Now, can I give you an example of that?
Yeah, that would be a priority.
Well, and it isn't what you think. When I was there and we were taking a tour of this area, there was a huge, I don't know how many acre field where there were trucks and wheelbarrows and axes and anything that you could imagine that would have been used to clean up the dirt and the stuff from when the explosion. And they had just taken it all there and plonked it in the field. And it was an open field. And so what happened was that people say, oh, God, we can go in there and take the motor out of that truck.
So what if it glows in the dark?
Yeah, so what if it glows in the dark? So there was a lot of stealing of
contaminated
material, and that had to be stopped. So we helped help them think about how they were going to do that. So that is another thing. Then I think the focus on health. There are many professionals in the United States doing studies, some in Kiev, on kids who were young when this happened. We need to have long-term research studies, and Americans are very definitely involved in that.
I think it's human nature to try to find the silver lining, if there's something terrible that happens, to say, well, at least it'll be a wake-up call or it'll lead to something positive. Coming out of this Chernobyl disaster from 1986, what can you point to where you think we've used it as a warning, we've made some changes or learned something from it?
You know, I'm not sure I can answer that, because even before the Chernobyl disaster, we knew it was going to be a Chernobyl disaster.
You mean that one was inevitable?
Yeah, because of the structure and management of the centers. You know, so we were already far ahead of that. They did not have any emergency response systems. We have very good emergency response systems. They didn't have and still don't have a medical system that is in any way, shape, or form able to deal with even today what's been left over. I don't think that we would be quite that stretched. I can think of Katrina, for example, and the huge number of people there. And sure, they didn't all get what they needed
very quickly.
Very quickly, but it wasn't too bad. So I'm not sure.
You have to wonder a little bit about, at least from the, let's say, Ukrainian, Russian, et cetera, standpoint, about the training and attitudes of the people in those reactor sites now. We hope that they're less cavalier about the way they conduct routine safety checks and other procedures.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I think that's being dealt with. know more about that in a couple of weeks after the 25th anniversary conference.
And how do you answer someone who, you know, looking at your nonprofit group, the focus group that works with the Chernobyl centers, someone who would say, well, but that's so long ago and so far away. Don't we have more pressing needs, or, you know, why focus on something that's 25 years old now?
Well, and yes, and I think you can say that about most anything, you know, and I'm sure there are more pressing needs in the world today. And one of them is going to be Japan. There's no question about that. And all of the murder and stress in Africa that's current, you know, that's terrible needs down there. But I guess we can't all deal with all of this. And my encouragement would be for people to think broader than they do. We're used to thinking about the world as a group of countries with borders around it. And I think, and then we talked about one world, you know, and sort of that was mystifying, but it was a nice round circle and so on. But now I think because of business interests and other kinds of interests that go across boundaries, we need to think globally. And I think that's what we need to help our kids in our classrooms and in our families think. You know, we are one world, and one little part of it is not going to be self-sustaining. It's going to have to go beyond that.
I do have to wonder, though, what was the, again, I'll say Soviet, but it would be these days more independent former Soviet republics, Russia and others. I have to wonder what the reaction was in terms of their use of nuclear power and reactors. I mean, they're still building reactors?
Yes, definitely. And Russia is going to other parts of the world to build them. And actually, they're going to build two new nuclear reactors in Ukraine in the next couple of years.
With some and, better safety?
Better personnel?
No, but Ukraine doesn't have any
other way to get
any
the
other
energy?
Way to get the energy. So even when you
much
talk
like Japan.
To people over there, they say, we'll just have to do a better job, but we have to have the nuclear plants. It's the only way we are going to have enough energy to live on. It's a terrible situation.
As you've been watching the news in Japan, how do you think your own background familiarity with the Chernobyl disaster sort of shaped how you see what's happening there?
Well, are you asking this as a personal question?
I guess.
Well, I have to say that the focus, the group that we chartered, is neither pro-nuclear nor anti-nuclear. And we have people on our board that represent both standpoints. But we need to address that issue with information and collaboration from both sides. It can't be all this or all that. But I will answer the personal question, and that is that I am more anti-nuclear now than I was before Japan. And the reason for that, I think, is we're dealing with something that we don't know about. There is so much about nuclear energy and nuclear science and nuclear whatever that we don't know. And therefore, I would be more cautious. I mean, look, in Japan, they have no idea what to do, how to do it. They've tried this and they've tried that and they've tried the next thing and it hasn't worked. and even the scientists say, God, we put this salt water down, and we didn't know this is what was going to happen. You know, and so if you don't know, then the consequences of trying to do this, it's difficult for me to say, oh, I'm just neutral.
Well, it is tricky, though, as you say, Norma, because if a place like Ukraine or Japan, if they don't have coal, let's say.
Or gas.
Are they in a position to import all of their energy source? It seems unlikely, doesn't it? You have to – I gather that the tendency is, as you've kind of implied, that part denial and part promise that you're going to do better with your next reactor seems to be what carries the momentum in terms of energy design today.
Yeah.
So nuclear power, despite Chernobyl, despite Japan,
I think it's here to
roll along.
It's here to stay. There's no question about it.
Norman mentioned some of the pictures by children from that area with the images that stay in your head. Are there particular stories or images that are always in your head when you think of Chernobyl and the cost in human terms?
Well, it's mixed. You go into the hospitals and you see the kids that are just fading away because of cancer, leukemia, and whatever.
And these are kids born after the disaster.
I'm talking about kids now, after.
But affected by the damaged DNA, presumably, of the parents?
Yes. And you see the mothers sitting at the side of these kids in the hospitals, and the mothers are frail and pale and wilted and sad. So that's one. You see that and your heart just aches, and you know that that's what you see, all you could see in any of the communities affected by Chernobyl. But then I go to one of the community centers that we support, and you see these kids running around, laughing, having a good time, whoa, 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 go, 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 you know, and then you think, oh, thank God. And so it's a mix, and somehow you have to get it in your head. It's both. It's both. And the young people that we've been told by the centers who work with them, they're not concerned so much about their health. They're concerned, and Chernobyl and what happened, they're concerned about their future life. They're concerned about, will I be able to go to school and get a higher education? How can I possibly do that? And if I can't do that, will I be able to find a job? Well, in these communities, there's the economic development is not there. So a lot of them just leave home and end up on the streets in Kiev with nothing. And that's not good.
So another less than obvious result of that accident at Chernobyl, all kinds of physical, political, and social consequences that are second, third generation away from the actual event. Our guest has been Norma Berkowitz. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thanks. It's been very enjoyable.
Catching us up on Chernobyl after 25 years. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.